This is Brian Taylor, and this is number 3 in a series of 7 talks for the course The Empty Way, Zen Buddhism and Contemplative Christianity. This week we get into an area that all seekers deal with at some point in the spiritual journey, effort and grace. Is it all up to us to grow, to heal, to evolve? Does God intervene and make things happen? Or is there some kind of a hidden dance between the two? We read Robert Kennedy's chapter 3 of his book, Zen Gifts to Christians. The chapter is called The Gift of Self-Reliance. And in the ox herding pictures on which he bases his book, in this image we have the ox who represents the enlightenment or Buddha nature. That the ox herder seeks, this ox disappears, and only the ox herder remains. Now Kennedy's interpretation of this is that the seeker, the ox herder, realizes that his true nature is already within, that he in fact is the ox, there is no separation. The term he uses for this lack of separation is self-reliance, which can be a bit misleading for some, in our culture especially, where self-reliance means that all on our own, with enough hard work, intelligence, and good luck, we can achieve anything we set our minds to. I don't think Kennedy is talking about this. What he says is that the true self, or our true nature, is not separate from us. And so we look within to find it, rather than chasing about externally. We're already one with God, with Christ. So the spiritual task is one of opening to a reality that we already possess, instead of building up some sort of a spiritual muscle that we don't yet have. This perspective is truly the contemplative one, and it stands outside of two other very common streams of Christian teachings that are best understood if for a moment we see each of them in their most extreme forms. The first of these is salvation by grace alone. It says that we are hopeless sinners, broken irreparably by original sin. We can do nothing on our own. We always mess it up. So it is God alone in Christ who can save us from ourselves. Our work is to give up and to surrender to this grace. St. Paul occasionally sounds like this. The reformers, especially Calvin and Luther, were convinced of this. We hear it a lot in evangelical churches today. The second approach is salvation by works. And that is the belief that we can, by our own efforts alone, achieve holiness. Pelagius is the best known of this proponent, a 4th to 5th century British theologian who emphasized free will. He believed that we are perfectly able to fulfill God's law. The only part that God had in it was really setting the law, and it's up to us to fulfill it. Pelagius was condemned by other theologians as a heretic. What is not often admitted is how common Pelagianism is among Christians throughout history, especially in the form of American civic Christianity, where moral uprightness and the choice to be a good person is a choice that we are always capable of making, and that's all there is to religion. You go to church, you hear what you're supposed to do, and you choose to do it. Now, most people will blend these two extremes and say, yes, we are imperfect, we never do things exactly right, but we are capable of some good, and we can, in partnership with God's grace, be relatively good and holy, probably in proportion to our willingness and the effort we put into it. There is truth to this. But the contemplative and the Buddhists come at it from a different direction entirely. We are, the contemplatives say, completely one with God already. The Buddhists would say that Buddha nature is inherent within all beings. But obviously there's a problem. We don't feel or behave as if this is so. There is sin, there is delusion. The problem is we don't know who we are. We think we are the false constructed self or the conditioned self, that that is who we are. And so we feed and maintain this conditioned self. The spiritual work is to uncover our true nature so that it might shine forth. And as it does, we no longer have to try to be good. Goodness itself is manifested. It is natural to us. and it is manifested from its divine source within us. It naturally rises up whenever what was blocking it is removed. And we do that uncovering, not just by liking the idea that we're all divine and having a feeling that there is a light shining in our hearts. The contemplative journey is a long process of understanding just how we obscure the divine nature within, how we block God's activity within us, how subtly we build the false self and maintain blockages to God's grace, coming to know the exact nature of our false conditioned self so that it withers up under the light of day. And so what is beneath it, our divine or Buddha nature, then has space to manifest. Here's an example. Let's say I'm angry and resentful towards another person. Now, if I took the approach of salvation by grace alone, I would feel bad about that, realize, oh yes, you're a sinner, confess the anger, and ask for forgiveness. Salvation by works alone would try to become a more loving and forgiving person. But the contemplative would face into the anger and resentment without shame or fear, hold it in full awareness, try to understand its origins, its triggers, the ways that we hold on to it and feed it, and over time, through awareness and exposure to the light of truth, this anger and resentment becomes thin, perhaps transparent, certainly less gripping, so that the natural quality of divine love and forgiveness that lie within is no longer blocked from doing what it wants to do. It has room to move. And at some point, we turn around and realize that we are feeling and behaving differently. So that for the contemplative, the spiritual journey is a process of subtraction, not addition. We are not building up a better self. If we did that, it would always be flawed and deluded, just a better version of flaw and delusion. We are exposing the flaws and delusions that we have accrued over time and letting them dissipate as we shine light on them, so that the divine nature that is our true nature, from which we have never been separate at all, is free to manifest itself through us. We become less so that God can become more. As St. Paul said, it's no longer I who live, but Christ within me. As John the Baptist said about Jesus, I must decrease, he must increase. Or as Jesus himself said, unless you deny yourself, you cannot enter the kingdom of heaven. Now, St. Paul also made the bold claim, we have the mind of Christ. This is very interesting. Not that we understand Christ's mind and so act accordingly and imitate him, but that we have Christ's mind. And again, not that you can someday attain Christ's mind by lots of effort, but we have Christ's mind. Zen people call it Buddha nature or big mind. It is our inherent nature and needs only to be uncovered to be manifest. In Searching for Metaphor, Paul also says that we are clothed with Christ, that the people together are the body of Christ, which is to say that we embody Christ's mind, Christ's being. I think it's in this sense that Kennedy speaks of self-reliance and confidence in one's ability to attain Buddha nature, not in some Pelagian, will-powered sense of personal achievement, but rather with confidence in the inherent divine nature, the Buddha nature, the Christ nature, which will manifest naturally as the false constructed self is deconstructed. Shunryu Suzuki, the author of Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, encourages us to have confidence in this nature. The big mind in which we must have confidence is not something which you can experience objectively. It is something which is always with you, always on your side. The mind which is always on your side is not just your mind, it is universal mind, always the same, not different from another's mind. It is Zen mind. It is big, big mind. In Zen, there are parallels to the dichotomy of salvation by grace or salvation by works. Zen Buddhism tends to emphasize what is called self-power. the power of the individual to grow into his or her Buddha's nature, to attain enlightenment by effort. And in its most extreme form, we see this sometimes in what I would call macho Zen. Some guy, usually a guy, sucking it up and sitting like a demon until he breaks through to enlightenment. But Pure Land Buddhism is sort of on the other extreme of things. It emphasizes other power, or salvation by grace, as Christians would call it. It's a very prevalent tradition found throughout Asia, the most common form of Buddhism in Asia. In Japan, 20% of the population practices it, and it's called Jodo Shinshu, or Shin Buddhism. It emphasizes other power. One is saved or enlightened by a celestial form of the Buddha known as Amitabha Buddha. And one practices a mantra by chanting Amitabha's Buddha name, the name of Amitabha Buddha. Now, this is very similar to the practice in Eastern Orthodoxy of the repetition of the Jesus prayer, repeating Jesus' name in a short phrase that goes along with it, as a way of entering into contemplative prayer with a mantra. For those who practice this in Buddhism, they open themselves up to the compassion of Amitabha, and this is what we would call grace. Now, many Zen teachers, however, see these two seemingly disparate points of view resolved, both grace and effort together. A reading that I've recommended this week is on this resolution of the two, written by my teacher in Chicago, Taigen Dan Layton, and it's called Dogen's Zazen as Other Power Practice. What Christians would call grace comes first of all, he says, through historical figures like the Buddha, the presence of the Buddha, and all the bodhisattvas and Zen teachers past and present, because past, present, and future in Buddhism are collapsed into one, into now. So that they are here now practicing with us, one mind, supporting us on our cushion. We are one with Buddha, we are one with all the bodhisattvas. So it is Buddha's own nature that rises up in our practice. As the 13th century Japanese Zen master Dogen wrote, just set aside your body and mind, forget about them, and throw them into the house of the Buddha. Then all is done by Buddha. Shunryu Suzuki, who many of you are reading during this course, writes, everything is Buddha's activity. So whatever you do, or even if you keep from doing something, Buddha is in that activity. Because people have no such understanding of Buddha, they think what they do is the most important thing without knowing who it is that is actually doing it. People think they are doing various things, but actually Buddha is doing everything. As Taigen points out in his article, grace is also available in the support of the Dharma. Now, the Dharma is a term in Buddhism that can be expressed in many different ways. Generally, it is the teaching of the Buddha, the teaching of the tradition. But more broadly, Dharma is whatever in life serves to awaken us, whatever becomes our teacher, whatever we allow to become our teacher. One of the verses in Zen services is, Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Which is to say, everything and everyone becomes my teacher. Many years ago, I had a very contentious relationship with a bishop whom I felt was unfair, unjust, and unkind. And my Zen teacher at the time said to me at one point when it was at its worst, your bishop is your teacher. And he was. He was a Dharma gate for me, an opportunity for awakening. Because he pushed my buttons, I became more aware of my own reactivity, my own delusions. Life is full of Dharma gates, opportunities for awakening. Another verse we used at a Zen center I attended was, life as it is, our only teacher. Dharma gates or grace are found in the natural world around us, in the beauty of the natural world, in other people, in the circumstances of our lives, because we are interdependent. The teacher or source of wisdom, healing, enlightenment is experience itself with which we are interdependent. The truth of life, the Dharma, as it is, ever flowing by and encompassing us on all sides, assisting us in our awakening if we allow it to. Now, people of faith might call this kind of grace panentheism, or God in everything. And if God is everywhere, a part of every moment, every person, every experience, then grace is everywhere, always helping us, and we are not alone with just our willpower to rely upon. Reb Anderson, the former abbot at the Zen Center of San Francisco, wrote a book on the Buddhist precepts called Being Upright. Now, the precepts are basically vows which one undertakes when one formally adheres to the Buddhist path. And in this book, Reb Anderson described an ancient teacher who, he said, quote, awoke to the world where everything we do is possible because of the support that we receive from and give to all beings. After this realization, the precepts were no longer something external that he imposed on himself, but instead emerged from him as natural expressions of his understanding of life. He knew what to do without deliberation. But this attainment came on only after many years of fruitless attempts to realize the precepts by personal power. And so he found that it was possible, that's the end of the quote, he found that it was possible to live the precepts because of the support that he received from all beings, from all of life, from all experience. Dharma gates are boundless. So through any of these traditions, whether it's Pure Land Buddhism, Zen, or contemplative Christian, when we approach life with an open mind, everything can be our teacher and a source of what we call grace. And in all of these traditions, there is a devotional aspect, therefore, to life. Giving thanks for this grace or for this other power. In Zen, we recite the names of the Buddhas, the Bodhisattvas, and the teachers in a litany during services. We make offerings in veneration. We bow to life as it is, filled with grace. And there's a kind of surrendering to this other power, a reliance upon it, a calling upon it for support, and again, having confidence in this support. This is no different in my mind from surrendering to God's grace and relying upon it. Now, having said all this, the other side of grace, of course, is our effort. We don't get anywhere in life without putting in some effort. And that's true of meditation, contemplative prayer, zazen. We have to sit ourselves down in the silence, face into the reality of what is, and choose to remain there, and choose to remain open. And we have to choose to read, to study, to take courses like you're doing right now. And this requires our best efforts. But what we're saying here is that effort alone is not enough, and grace is always present and available. Now I'd like to introduce you to a way of doing zazen, or contemplative prayer, that might make this dance between effort and grace more experiential and not just ideas. What follows might be best to use when you're prepared to sit for a period of meditation as a guided introduction that leads you into silence. As you begin, as usual, sit upright. Focus on your breath. Focus on your body and the cushion. Ask for the Spirit's grace to support you. Ask for the communion of saints, the Bodhisattvas, Buddha, the Christ, to support you. Trust in this hidden but very real presence. Place your confidence in this support, which is always on your side. Expand your awareness to the room around you, the light in the room, the ambient sounds, the people in your neighborhood, the wide world around you and the sky above, the earth beneath. All of it supporting you in your practice, in your effort. Thoughts arise on their own as the brain generates them. Let them come, let them go. Allow your consciousness, your sensory awareness, your thoughts to be just one element in the vast suchness of now. Instead of allowing your mind to be all that there is, allow everything else to be present as well, all at once. So that everything, the rich suchness of now, sound, light, feeling, your thoughts, sensations, the spirit, the saints, the bodhisattvas, all of it is like a vast symphony. And your consciousness is only one player in that symphony, like perhaps the third violin. Try to see and hear the whole symphony at once, and not just yourself. Let the symphony of now play itself. You're not limited to your mind, your body, your consciousness, even your circumstances. You are everything at once. You are the light, the sounds, the air, the world, other people, God. It is you. All of this is God's one body manifested at once. So as you continue in silence, sit in this broadest kind of attention, open to everything, happy to just be one player in the vast symphony of God's world. And after a period of silence, end by thanking the Spirit, the saints, the Buddhas past and present, the world itself, all of whom have supported you in your practice, in your effort.